From live from the Left Coast Productions, this is In Deep. This hour, sexual assault is on the rise in the U.S. military, so Fox's Liz Trotta says, what do they think would happen? And blamed feminists. One of Rick Santorum's biggest funders urged gals to hold aspirin between their knees as birth control. And the latest ad from PETA gets a laugh out of battered women, the war on women. It's our topic this hour on In Deep. And before we swing into our topic du jour, let us take a look at some of the news stories you may have missed over the course of the week, including one that matters to all of us who spend a good deal of time on the computer. This from computerworld.com. Monitoring of sites like Facebook, Twitter, and others by the government is prompting calls for oversight. There's a privacy tussle brewing. Again, this is computerworld.com. A major tussle is emerging in the debate over how government agencies can gather and use the info posted publicly on social networks like Facebook and Twitter. The Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and other agencies contend social media monitoring is a vital part of their efforts to keep abreast of events that could pose threats to national security and public safety. Privacy advocates, maintain that unfettered social media monitoring by the government will chill free speech and intrude upon privacy and civil rights. Now, the tussle may be new, but the wisdom is not. The wisdom is, if you don't want everyone to know it, don't put it on your Facebook page. Don't be silly. There is no real privacy on the internet as yet, and may never be. We look to another story. It is very grim, but it's very important for you to hear. It has to do with our conversation about ALEC last week, the American Legislative Exchange Council. I'll get back to that. Listen to everything that leads up to that. This is a glimpse of a right-wing paradise, a conservative fiscal Garden of Eden, Pontiac, Michigan, where Republican Governor Rick Snyder has essentially cut the legs out from under any local authorities. You can find this article online by Paul About. It's published at motherjones.com and a number of other sites. The governor there has invoked a new law that was brought onto the books under his watch that lets emergency managers, as they're called, nullify labor contracts, privatize public services, sell off city property, and dismiss elected officials. This is a Republican conservative wet dream. Now, he has an appointed gun. Snyder's trigger man went into Pontiac, Michigan, fired the city clerk right away, fired the city attorney and the director of public works. Now, let me quote directly from the article. When the city shut down its fire department last Christmas Eve, City Councilman Kermit Williams learned about it in the morning paper. City Councilman found out that the fire department was closed down on Christmas Eve when he read about it in the paper. He says, nobody reports to me anymore. It just gets reported in the press. He and his six colleagues on the council have been stripped of their salary and their official powers. Note here, I'm talking about the elected officials. I'm talking about the people of the city going to the polls and electing the people who will stand for them in the making and enforcement of laws. And the governor has stripped them of their salary and official powers through this trigger man. Nearly the whole city has been privatized, the man laments. And there's more. It's happening in other we understand, and when I say we, you, I, almost everyone gets it. Michigan is in really dire straits because of the depression we're in. But this is being feasted upon by fiscal conservatives who love the idea of walking in, busting unions, silencing the people, and privatizing facilities, buildings, and land for their and their buddies' benefits. And you want to know how crazy it gets? It gets so crazy that Benton Harbor's emergency manager, Benton Harbor is another Michigan town, Benton Harbor's emergency manager banned elected officials from appearing at city meetings without his consent. Can I give you that sentence again? Because I couldn't believe it. Benton Harbor's emergency manager banned elected officials from appearing at city council meetings without his consent. So you want to bring this home to ALEC? The aforementioned trigger man going in there to do the behest of the governor is a member of the Mackinac Center. The Mackinac Center, in its turn, is a member of, yes, you guessed it, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, whose sole purpose is to churn out legislation that works on behalf of the moneyed few, hand it over to complicit legislators, and it becomes law in the U.S. And if you don't know about that, go listen to last week's show where we go into it for a whole hour. Scary stuff, and I do want you to be aware of it. You know, we need something uplifting after that, shall we? This is a good one. You remember the Super Bowl ad, Pete Hoekstra, U.S. Senate primary campaign, and he had that racist cliche of the money-hungry Asian woman. She couldn't speak pure English, of course, because she was one of them foreigners. It was really bad. Well, a very funny thing happened on the way to the polls for Mr. Hoekstra. Not that he's there yet, but already, the actress involved in that spot has publicly apologized for her involvement on her Facebook page. She says, "I'm deeply sorry for any pain the character I portrayed brought to my communities. This role is not in any way representative of who I am. It was absolutely a mistake on my part and one that over time I hope can be forgiven." And then public policy polling reports, 54% of Michigan voters are aware of the ad. 45% said it made them less inclined to vote for him. And now the Democratic incumbent has moved from a 9-point to a 14-point lead over Hoekstra. And that gives Nelson Muntz the last word as we look at the news of the week you might have missed. We go ahead and move into our next full hour here on In Deep. I'm Angie Goyro. This is In Deep, and our inspiration for the topic for this hour came from Twitter. It was about 2 years ago I started to see the hashtag War on Women. People were popping it onto their tweets about anti-choice legislation, fundamentalist restrictions on women's freedoms, the battle over contraception. And I remember saying to myself at the time, war on women? A bit of an overstatement. But it was like seeing something that you, once you've seen it, you're never able to unsee it. And gradually, the accumulation of anti-woman policies, misogyny in the public discourse, anti-feminist rhetoric, it all became kind of undeniable. And I do believe now that, you know, whether it's organized or not, whether there are four-star generals at the head of it, you know, identifiable leaders with deliberate strategy, whether or not that's the case, yes, there is a cultural battle being fought over the full rights, identity, and dignity of women in the U.S. Now, later this hour, we're going to talk to author Nancy L. Cohen. She sees this as part of a backlash to the sexual revolution. And we'll talk to activist Gloria Felt. You probably know her name. She served as CEO of Planned Parenthood for almost 10 years. Right now, we're going to focus on the state of Kentucky. Wednesday of this week, the Oklahoma State Senate passed the Personhood Bill, and that gives zygotes all the same rights as living, breathing, born human beings. One state senator got fed up with the double standard being applied to women's reproductive capacity, and her story just gets better from there. And I'm very pleased to introduce to In Deep Constance Johnson. She is Senator of Oklahoma, and she made headlines around the personhood debate in a way that I have to say Senator Johnson was novel, was unique, and it was certainly deserving of all the attention that it's getting. So thank you for speaking to us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
I had to laugh because before we get into details about the movement that you started with the personhood bill, SB 1433, almost every blog I saw that put this piece of information out in the world, they accompanied it with the Monty Python song, "Every Sperm is Sacred." And that's kind of the mentality that you were reflecting in 1433. So let's talk about what that is and why you introduced it.
You know, and I had never heard of that song before, and I thought, well, did they write the song for this amendment? But that, to me, is the crux of the issue. It takes two people to create life, a man and a woman. And in Oklahoma, consistently, we only focus on issues about women and limiting their reproductive health choices and options. And I, for the last 31 years, I was a Senate staff person prior to becoming a senator, and I actually drafted legislation. And when the Democrats were in power, we were able to keep the reins down on anti-abortion kinds of legislation. Well, as soon as the Republicans got the majority, they started pushing that agenda. And so after 6 years of watching them pass bill after bill limiting women's rights, this was just my final statement to say, maybe they just don't hear me. Maybe I need to make it plain. And I'm just a person who likes to keep it real.
You certainly did. This is the proposed amendment to the personhood bill that's had so much discussion publicly. And the amendment reads, any action in which a man ejaculates or otherwise deposit semen anywhere but in a woman's vagina shall be interpreted and construed as an action against an unborn child. What kind of reaction did you get when you introduced that?
You know, it was there were a lot of shenanigans going on in the committee, and at one point we thought they weren't going to hear our amendments. There was one other amendment. And so the author of that amendment introduced it, and of course they immediately moved to table it. And they did that. So I just decided to have some comments in my questioning and go ahead and talk about my amendment. And then the chair said, well, no, Senator, we're going to let you hear your amendment. So they read the amendment, and the author said that he was just having difficulty dealing with the terminology of the amendment. And I looked and I wondered, what was he talking about? Because I didn't think I had used anything derogatory. I think that's the official term for that action.
Yes.
And I just couldn't figure out where he was coming from in terms of having concerns about what was said. But he continues to say that. So,
you know, I don't want to come across as someone who's just, you know, so married to a point of view that I can't see the other side. I like to think that I'm a little more nuanced than that. But in this particular case, I feel like when you try to make the dialogue real, there's still in there my, I don't know if it's the old hangover of sex is dirty, or if it's just, I don't want to be that frank about, I don't know what it is, but it just seems like there's a whole sector of the public, many of whom have somehow migrated into power, who just can't deal with frankness around sexuality.
I think that's true, but I think we're growing out of those people. And I think that's why so many people across the country are really excited and you know, just in awe of the amendment. Because it is the real deal. You know, I know exactly what you're talking about in terms of folks in my mom's generation and, you know, shortly after that, she was born during the Depression. But, you know, it's just not something that you say, not something that you talk about. It's an unspoken rule in the culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was trying to make a point that I've been trying to make for 6 years. And finally, you know, the papers outside of Oklahoma picked it up first before the papers in state. And once it went viral internationally even, then the local media decided that they would cover it.
Nice of them to make room for you.
Yeah, well, Oklahoma's conservative looking, but I just believe it's more progressive than what we give it credit for. And this is, I believe, I'm hoping it's going to be an issue that turns this thing around in Oklahoma. If we can't have real conversations about the biological functions that go to create life and, you know, in the conversation about when does life begin, and I'm not sure I even know when life begins, and I don't believe that that's up to us to even concern ourselves with. I believe God determines that. And so you know, I just think if this conversation, if we start to have that conversation and we can continue to keep it real, we might can make a difference in Oklahoma. There are so many women and men here who are so upset about this personhood bill that's going forward.
You know, the theme of our hour is the war on women. And, you know, we're questioning not only all of these elements, the contraception bill that, of course, has been so discussed, with Barack Obama's attempt to get contraceptives underwritten either by the employer or by the insurance company. And there are many things that are coming up on the Republican campaign trail that are conceivably, you call them anti-women. And whether you think that is an organized, you know, quote unquote, war on women effort or not, there does seem to be an awful lot of this kind of thing going around.
It's pretty strange.
It is strange. And I wonder, with the people that you are side by side with in the Oklahoma Senate, do you get the feeling from other actions of these proponents of the personhood bill that they come from a naturally misogynist point of view?
I'm afraid I do. I don't have any other explanation for it. It's consistent. It's thorough. I mean, they don't blink when they say anything. It's you know, I respect people's rights to have their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But on this issue, they are unwilling to hear anything different from what they think. And what I really appreciated about this opportunity was for women in Oklahoma, they have someone who is willing to add their voice in the chamber to the conversation. And perhaps we've not had that in a long time. And the interesting thing, Angie, is of the four of us who debated the bill ferociously, three of them are leaving this year.
Oh.
I was the only one left.
Hmm.
I mean, consider what happened on the Capitol Hill today with the all-male committee talking about when life begins and
yes.
conception. And how dare them exclude women from the panel?
How can, you know, what amazes me is how that never even crossed anybody's mind, even if all they were caring about was the appearance. Even if they didn't care about the heart of the issue, I mean, just the appearance of an all-male panel.
I think we're just giving them too much credit.
Hmm.
I mean, and so we're talking about all of a sudden these things are going on, and for that to happen today, and the personhood yesterday, and the president's initiative, what, two or three weeks ago, and then the issue with Planned Parenthood and Susan B. Komen, all of these things are starting to unwind right now in this moment, and I think it's pretty awesome. I think it's pretty... mandated at a higher level than us. I think it's our time. I think it's time for women to step up. We're in the majority, but we've never been led to believe that we have power.
Mm-hmm.
But we create life. We're the ones who carry the baby, who nurture it, and when we come to the table, we get a finer product. I'll give men credit for doing what they do, but when you introduce women into the policy arena, you get a much better product. You get a much more thoughtful, consistent, and compassionate product. So I think just we're looking at the moment whose time has come.
I don't want to run the risk of putting you up on a pedestal, so forgive me if that's the way this comes apart. I'm so pleased to hear that you are active and assertive in the Oklahoma Senate, and I wonder if any young women have contacted you or in any other way acknowledged that maybe they'll come up behind you because they're inspired by you.
I have some, yes.
Yay.
Yes. And every woman I see, if she even looks like she might want to run, I'm encouraging them to just believe. We have a group here called Sally's List, and I'm very active in that list. We're trying to recruit more women candidates. It's real interesting. In our caucus, even, for example, when they go out and recruit candidates, they don't recruit women.
No.
No. It's such a good old boy club.
Wow.
And there's time. It's time for change.
It is. It's so much of this debate on all the issues we've been discussing, I keep wondering what decade it is. So I really hope you're right. I hope it's our time.
Yep. And you know what? I'm not ready to be up on a pedestal. This is not my style, but at the same time, it happened. I'm glad it did. I'm glad to be where I am. I believe I'm here for a purpose, and only God could orchestrate the things the way they've gone right now.
Senator Johnson, I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Senator Constance Johnson, we're going to put a link up on our website to her work that she put together for The Guardian UK on her amendment to the personhood bill. I'm Angie Coyle. You're listening to In Deep.
Well, I hear you women talking about your monkey men, about your no-count husbands and their trifling friends. Peaceful women sit around all day and moan. They wondering why they're wondering papas don't come home. But wild women don't worry. Wild women never get the blues. Well, if you got a man, don't be on the square. 'Cause if you do, he'll have a woman everywhere. I never have been known to treat no one man right. I keep some working hard both the day and night. 'Cause wild women don't worry. Wild women never get the blues. Way of my of good liquor, walk the streets at night, come home and puts my man out if he don't do right. 'Cause wild women don't worry, wild women.
Welcome back to In Deep. I'm Angie Caro, continuing our conversation on the war on women. That phrase started to pop up on the internet, I don't know how long ago, and it's gained more and more purchase. And whether you subscribe to the theory that there is a war on women with generals and strategy and logic behind it, or it's just this cascade of nasty things happening all at once that reveal the undercurrent of what our society thinks about women, no matter where on that spectrum you view it, it's hard to deny there are an awful lot of anti-woman things happening right now. And my next guest has a wonderful context to place this in, wonderful in the sense of it explains not that it's going to make you smile. Her new book is Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. Her name is Nancy L. Cohen, and I'm very pleased to have her on the air with us. Nancy, hi.
Hi, Angie. Great to be here with you.
I'm going to subject you to a media barrage, because one of the things I referenced earlier in the show is just how many things have been happening this week that reflect, to some extent, society's view of women, or at least the point of view held by a large part of society. I was very surprised to see this first clip come out of PETA, and I'm going to play this PETA ad for you, meant to be funny, which is astounding to me. The graphic is a young woman struggling, obviously in pain, along a sidewalk. She is bruised. Her clothing is in disarray. She has a neck brace on. And at one point, as she's walking up a stairway, it's very clear she's having trouble walking. So let's hear that.
This is Jessica. She suffers from BWV-AKT boom. Boyfriend went vegan and knocked the bottom out of me. A painful condition that occurs when boyfriends go vegan and can suddenly bring it like a tantric porn star. For Jessica, it's too late.
Oh, you're back. You feeling better?
Please go to bwvaktboom.com and learn to go vegan safely.
And in that hysterically funny clip, you're seeing the woman turn on her smile when she sees the young man again and she starts to peel off her clothing. I can't begin, Nancy Cohen, I can't begin to ponder all the misconceptions and harmful myths that are encompassed in that 15 or 20 second commercial.
Yeah, it really, you just want to say, wow, astounding. So what it brings to mind to me is our real discomfort as a society about sex and healthy sex. And that, you know, I've been reading and we hear about how much, you know, pornography has been infecting, you know, young people to mm-hmm. the point where they think this is actually the way real sex takes place. So my only guess about this is that it's a reflection of that porn culture, that they think this is okay.
That's fascinating. That's an aspect of it I hadn't heard about. Or I hadn't thought about. When we look at that, and when we look at so many other pictures of women that show up in the media and some of the characterizations of women that have been popping up politically of late, are there any historic issues that are cropping up again, cropping up anew in here? Any cliches, any of the imagery of women that you're looking at it and saying, oh gosh, not again?
Well, we certainly see that in what the Republican Party and Republican candidates are saying are women's proper roles. You know, Santorum had to admit that his stay-at-home wife wrote the passage of his book attacking working mothers and blaming radical feminists for destroying women's true role He also said that women shouldn't be serving at the front lines, even though 100-some have died and 800-some have been killed at the front lines already.
Mm-hmm.
So this goes back to something I talk about in my book, is what I call the sexual counter-revolution, is that basically with the changes brought on by the sexual revolution and gay rights and feminism in the 70s, there was a real reaction against them and a movement of people who really want to control sex formed and became incredibly powerful and took over the Republican Party. And that's what we're seeing today with hearings about birth control, with a bunch of men, half of whom are celibate, testifying on birth control. Crazy.
Well, yeah, although that, and we were talking about historical images, I mean, patriarchal countries, patriarchal religions telling women how to behave and what their bodies are for is a recurrent theme. And we just can't seem to get away from that, even though it sounds so, you know, 8th century.
I know. It is a recurring theme. I think what's going on in America now, though, is that is not something that, say, 80% of the country shares. 80% of the country is pretty progressive on these gender issues. And I really think it's a very tiny minority that is driving the debate so far to the right and hijacking the discourse over things like gay marriage and birth control that are no-brainers to most of the population.
Well, then why do these people seem to have so much traction? Who is it that's following them? Who is it that's throwing money at them? Why do they seem to be succeeding so wildly?
Because they are absolutely brilliant political organizers. They started about 40 years ago, and they worked on the grassroots level, and then they worked on the level of the PTA, and then they worked on the level of local school boards and local Republican parties. And so the religious right, if you want to call them that, I call them sexual fundamentalists, formed this movement in the 70s, and they methodically took over the Republican Party from the bottom to the top. And the key point is they started at the bottom, and they stayed engaged in electoral politics. They don't give up when they lose elections. They just organize under a new brand, say the Tea Party. And then before we know it, they're back in power.
Nancy Cohen's an historian and author, and she does have her book coming out this week, Delirium, How the Sexual Counterrevolution is Polarizing America. I had mentioned earlier the idea of which people are throwing money at these campaigns. Foster Freeze is one of those. What an unusual name. But if you think
yes, it's the name of the ice cream shop down the street from me. I have to look it up and see if I can still go there and take my kids there.
We may kill your appetite for ice cream and anything else with this next quote. He was being interviewed on CNN by Andrea Mitchell and astoundingly came out with this.
Well, I get such a chuckle when these things come out. Here we have millions of our fellow Americans unemployed. We have jihadist camps being set up in Latin America, which Rick has been warning about. And people seem to be so preoccupied with sex that I think it says something about our culture. This contraceptive thing, my gosh, it's such inexpensive. You know, back in my days, they used bear aspirin for contraceptives. The gals put it between their knees, and it wasn't that costly.
The gals put it between their knees. Now, the connective thread there, Foster Freeze, is the biggest contributor.
And he's a scientist, too.
Oh, that's appalling.
Air aspirin, that'll work really well.
You know, what amazes me, and maybe this speaks to the very polarization of America that you're talking about in your book, I look at someone like that, you know, an older, self-satisfied, smug white guy with a smirk on his face telling the gals what to do, and I physically recoil. I feel that in my gut, and I'm appalled, and I'm nauseated. And somehow, there is a thread of Americans that appeals wildly to.
Yes, but they are a tiny minority, 15%, maybe up to 20%. They are older. They are whiter. They are extremely religious, and all of these groups are actually getting smaller in the American population. So even the very religious young people don't necessarily agree with these old guys on things like gay marriage. So I do think there's hope that this really kind of Neanderthal view is fading away. Mm-hmm. But people like Foster Freeze have a lot of money to fund candidates that are so extreme, like Rick Santorum. And so we do have to kind of stay alert to their power, even though they have nothing like, you know, a majority behind them for these far-out things that they want to do.
Although it's really instructive to look at the Santorum campaign's response to that. Immediately when this hit the headlines, the Santorum campaign set out and said, we cannot answer for him. He's an individual. He has nothing to do with us. Now, here's a gentleman who has nothing to do with them, who has given them, you know, well into the six figures in cash. But they've got that nice, clean division that, his is the political action committee, while Santorum's is the campaign. Nobody's yeah. fooled by that. But the right gets to play, and I have to give them credit. They play this very well. They can have their attack dogs out there saying what is too extreme for them to say themselves, and they have the plausible deniability of saying, well, we're not the ones who said, we would never say such a demeaning thing. And they get to take the spoils either way.
Yeah, though I have faith in the American public that they're not going to buy it when it's that extreme, and that they, in this post-Citizens United world, that people don't make a distinction between these super PACs and the cannabis when it's so obvious that they're listening to each other's message and adopting it, except when they don't like, you know, something this crazy that their super PAC says. So I think you have to remember they're in the Republican primary right now, and what he said is not going to hurt him in the Republican primary, mm-hmm. actually. It will hurt him very much in the general election, and, you know, I have confidence that Obama will be able to use these messages, I hope.
Yes, knock all available wood on that one.
Yes.
Talking to Nancy Cohen on our topic of the war on women. And Nancy, I want to let our audience know, I have a copy of your book on the way, and I'm going to be interviewing you for a whole hour, which I'm really looking forward to. But I noticed on the front page of your website, nancylcohen.com, that the book Delirium goes into something that's very important to us here at the show, and that's to say that the shadow movement that is responsible for America's broken politics is deep within both parties. And we're always careful to say this is not a good guy's, bad guy's picture, be it civil rights, human rights, women's rights, gay rights. You know, you can't just say, you know, here are the guys in the white hats, here are the guys in the black hats. Both parties have a lot to answer for. We hear very little yeah. about how this party or how this the movement is at work on the Democratic side, but you go into that.
Yes. So the Democratic Party, to be sure, is far more progressive on issues of gender equality and personal freedom. And, you know, they're moving ahead on gay marriage. You know, New Jersey just passed gay marriage just an hour before we were talking now. So the problem for the Democrats is when they're in power, they're so divided that they can't get enough done, and then when they get thrown out of power, often for not getting enough done, they overreact. And here's where the sexual counter-revolution comes in the Democratic Party. They have this default position that when they lose elections, they blame their base, they blame progressives, they blame women, they blame gays, they blame feminists, and say, you know what, if you would just be quiet about all these social issues, we'd be able to attract the economically populist but socially conservative white men out there. Now, this is utter bunk that there are millions of white men fleeing the Democratic Party because they're socially conservative. All the studies show that actually these white men who might be leaving are pretty liberal on social issues. They're pro-choice. They're certainly pro-birth control. But they don't like the Democrats anymore for their economic policies. They're not economic liberals anymore. Mm-hmm. So Democrats, you know, blame their base, and then they run scared on these social issues, and then you get a midterm election where they're not bothering to stand up for their principles, and Democrats stay home. So in 2010, 40 million people who voted in 2008 stayed home. And that's how the Tea Party was able to sweep into power. And so I believe that if the Democrats would more fully embrace, you know, the public's live and let live attitude and cultural progressivism, it would be right on principle, but they'd also have a better chance in close elections.
It's interesting to me because this is not the first time I've heard very convincing arguments that the way the Democrats perceive the world is not necessarily in keeping with polls and available data that's out there. That doesn't exactly jibe with the idea that politicians have access to plenty of money, plenty of research, plenty of strategists. How can their information, their motivations be so wrong?
Well, part of it, and I don't mean to get too wonky here, but a lot of the studies that show that they're wrong about this are written by academics. They're, you know, they're regressions by political scientists and sociologists that really contradict the raw data from the exit polls. And often the information doesn't come out for a year or two after the election. But, you know, I did it. I read all the stuff. And actually, I went in with exactly this idea that, oh, Democrats, you know, get hurt by being socially liberal. And, you know, I was disabused of it by reading, you know, the academic literature. So I did it so you don't have to, but trust me, it is.
Nancy Alcoa, I want to
send a subscription to the Political Science Quarterlies to every Democratic strategist.
And isn't that ironic? Because, of course, the latest stream of rhetoric from the left has been that, you know, people who are progressive are so much smarter than people who aren't. And you'd think that they just read academic papers for breakfast every day. But apparently that's not true either. Do you think that what we're seeing coming from the right on issues of contraception, on issues of women's sexuality, are we hitting a new extreme here, or is it just getting more publicity? What's happening there?
Republicans, when they get into power in these elections like the 1994 midterms, Bush's reelection in 2004, and 2010, they overreach. And it's their ideological purists who do the overreaching. So we're seeing more extreme politics because the grassroots of the Republican Party are forcing politicians into a more extreme position. Mm. It's not more extreme views. They've always held these views where about, you know, this hostility toward sexual freedom. And I think it's just now that we're really seeing that that's what's at the core of this, because they have been overconfident this year. I believe they're going to get hurt by doing it, but, you know, they've gone so far down this path that I don't think there's any hope for them to come back to a position where they might appeal to mainstream America.
Nancy, one of the things that I can't quite wrap my mind around what the answer might be to this, because so much of what happens with women's imagery seems to try to run away from women having a full sexuality and, you know, a fully realized life. What is so scary about a fully realized, fully sexually free woman? Why is that so terrifying that it has to be worked against for generations?
I think the only people that it's still terrifying to are the very fundamentalist, very religious people who are members of religions that have an authoritarian view of sex and women and the family.
Nancy L. Cohen, this has just been a wonderful conversation, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Andrew. It's been great talking to you.
And I'll be talking to Nancy again when she's out toward the West Coast with her book. Her book, again, is Delirium, How the Sexual Counterrevolution is Polarizing America. Coming up next, longtime activist and former head of Planned Parenthood Gloria Felt on what she's learned from her years in the trenches. Stick around. I'm Angie Cuero. This is In Deep. Welcome back to In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero, and our topic this hour is the war on women. Now, that hashtag has caught on Twitter, and it's a concept that, you have to admit, has a lot of circumstantial evidence to support the idea that it does exist, and that's why we think it's worth probing this hour. Our next guest is ideal for this conversation. She has seen more than one battle in the ongoing struggle. In fact, Gloria Felt headed Planned Parenthood for a solid 10 years and did a lot of landmark work while she was there. And Planned Parenthood is just the beginning of what she's done. She is an author, a commentator, a feminist leader. She works at Arizona State University as a professor of practice. One of her courses there is called Women, Power, and Leadership. She has a number of publications behind her. And Seal Press has her latest, No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. With that kind of schedule, Gloria Felt, I thank you for making room for us.
It's my pleasure. I'm delighted to be with you today, Angie.
I have to ask you, we've reviewed over the course of the hour a number of the news stories that have come out. Some involve legislation, some involved some disturbing off-the-cuff remarks. Do you put those together in your mind and roll them into a war on women, as we've heard from others?
Well, one of the things I think we're witnessing is people being in a state of shock, absolute shock, that anyone could even begin to challenge the notion that contraception should be available to women to help them plan and space their childbearing in a responsible and healthy way. It so boggles the imagination of so many people that they can't really even begin to imagine why anybody would be doing this. But you have to really dig down to the roots of this battle, and I guess I'm already starting to use war terminology, aren't I?
It's tempting, isn't it?
You almost have to in the end, unfortunately. And the thing is that the rhetoric that has been used for the past 35, 40 years against abortion is exactly the same rhetoric that previous to the decision about in Roe versus Wade was used against contraception. And it is almost exactly the same rhetoric as was used starting in the 19th century as the women's movement began to develop. And it's always about the nature and purpose of human sexuality, which is sort of code for what is the role and the place of women in this world. And so from the perspective of, you know, I mean, war on women is a bit of a hyperbole, but it really is nothing less than that. And the problem is that I think women don't really get how deeply these attacks on women's rights go.
Well, one of the things that really set some people back on their heels this week, and there were plenty of them, was when Fox News commentator Liz Trotta said that women in the military complain that they have been raped too much. I believe her point was talking about whether women belong in the military, which is something debatable, perhaps, but this concept that they complain they've been raped too much was astounding. And
what? They're supposed to lie back and think of England?
Yes.
What? What
are they, or apparently there's a quota involved here. But but I guess my question was, someone like her, this is someone who is educated, someone who is theoretically aware, who keeps up on current events. What can you guess from your exposure to women who have this kind of things come out of their mouths, from Phyllis Schlafly to the people we have in our faces today? What's the mentality behind that? Are these people who are sacrificing their own dignity on behalf of some larger principle? Or are they people who have internalized negative messages about themselves and are perpetuating them? What the heck is going on there?
Well, yes, of course, there is always an element of co-option. There is an element also of simply, where do they get the most rewards from? And if you're talking about a commentator on Fox News, where do you think she gets her rewards from? She gets her rewards from a very right-wing, patriarchal framework on the world. So that's not, you know, that's not terribly surprising. I mean, one of the things I actually have a whole chapter on the whole issue of co-option in No Excuses, because it is very hard to see a culture. It's hard to see the water you swim in, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to change a culture while you're living in it. And frankly, when you start to make these very big fundamental changes in society, you are going to have some pushback, not just from people who oppose you, who are not even on your team, but from people who look like you but sound like the other guys. And that's just, that always happens. It's, you know, it's just like, for example, remember Ward Connerly's attempt to get rid of affirmative action
policies
in California. So you had an African-American man who was leading the charge to get rid of affirmative action, which had was probably a big part of the reason why he had been able to do what he was able to do. And so every oppressed group has people within it who will identify more with their oppressors than with those who are attempting to really reach out and achieve a more just society for everyone. Because there's a lot to lose when you start making those big changes in society. And frankly, if you think about it, women reaching equality in our society is the biggest change of any you can think of because it affects the most people.
Gloria Felt is the author of, among other books, No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power, and 2004's The War on Choice, The Right-Wing Attack on Women's Rights and How to Fight Back. When you talk about co-option, I can see how that can work for people on Fox's payroll. I can see how it can work for people who work in lobbying communities. I have questions about the rank and file. I have questions about the people who stand to make no money, who draw no paycheck, and yet seem to be willing to work against their own best interests, and often in ways where they hold contradictory thoughts. I know it's not uncommon. This is deep and ugly secrets from all my years working as a Planned Parenthood volunteer defender. We would see the people across the street one day shouting about God and holding up their placards, and the next weekend they'd be sneaking their daughters in the back door.
Absolutely, because this time it's me. This
right.
time it's me. It's my life. It's my daughter. It's different. It's different. It's very situational. And sometimes if you can get people just at that situational moment, you can get them to see the illogic. You get them to open up and even change their position. I know I was just watching a video that was making the rounds this past week of a state legislator, a Republican conservative woman who had changed her vote on same-sex marriage and decided to vote in favor of it. And she gave a very impassioned speech about how she had come to understand that this was about personal relationships. It was about love. It wasn't about a sexual act, per se. Well, I was waiting for the punchline because I had a feeling it would be coming. And sure enough, she had a daughter who had recently come out as being gay.
Mm.
You know, everybody has a personal story, and when you have that moment of truth and that personal story is you, suddenly you see life differently. And if you can catch people at that moment, you can actually get them to change their value set or the value set that they say publicly that they espouse.
You know, one of the things that we try to do when we try to triage a little bit. This person is persuadable. This person is not persuadable. And we often come up against religious ideals. I've talked a lot on the air about the Dominionists, about the people who want us to live in an Old Testament world, both legally and constitutionally, and personally as well. And I wonder how much crossover there is on this topic. Those who would take rights away from women and be that full protection in the military or access to contraceptives, you know, the full spectrum of health care, even, you know, access to jobs in the workplace. Do we discard those people who are coming from a religious point of view because they are, in essence, not persuadable?
Well, I think a certain percentage of them are not persuadable. It's true that the more fundamentalist the religion, and it doesn't matter if it's a Muslim, a Jew, a Christian, it doesn't matter. If the more fundamentalist the religion is, the more misogynistic it tends to be, and the less persuadable those people will be. They are entitled to their opinions. Let them have them. But they are not entitled to impose those same opinions on me. I have a different religious point of view, and I expect to be able to live by my religious precepts as well. And I think in a pluralistic society, there has to be that way of looking at it. Let me also say that in the 60s in particular, as reproductive rights were really coming into the fore, it was mainstream clergy who led the charge very often to try to get legalization of birth control, legalization of abortion, the ability for women to have access to reproductive health care services. Most of the mainline Protestant denominations have very specific and clear pro-family planning and pro-choice positions, as do Reform and conservative Jewish denominations. So those can be some of our strongest supporters, but I'm telling you, they really need to be speaking out right now. We're missing those voices.
Do you think those voices have full access to the media? They're making an effort to speak and they're not being heard? Because I know if it bleeds, it leads. I know if you're the most extreme person, you're the one who's going to get the microphone. Or is this an issue of they're sitting back and being quiet?
It's some of each. I think it's some of each. It certainly is true that the more flamboyant you are and the more extreme your position is, the more likely you are to get a little ink and airtime. But that just means we have to work about five times as hard, because we can't use that as an excuse. We need to, if I can cite one of the power tools I have in No Excuses, and I want to say that, I mean, my position on this is, yes, there are all kinds of reasons why these things happen, but there just aren't any excuses. We need to see what the reasons are, but then we need to just take hold, and we need to make our voices heard. And I think that now with social media particularly, there are so many ways that we can make our voices heard that we really can overcome the din from the other side. But we have to be courageous. You have to stand up. You have to speak your piece. You have to speak it first. You have to speak it last. You have to speak it over and over and over again. And I think most importantly, what we need to do is to really focus on the issues of women's personhood, women's human right, women's civil right to make our own childbearing decisions. I think too often we let the argument get small. We let it get to be about abortion. Well, it's not abortion. It's never been about abortion. It's about women. It's about you. It's about your daughter. It's about your friend. It's about what we as women want to be able to do in our lives and want to be able to have the freedom to do. So we need to make sure that we're framing the issues in a way that really helps people understand what's at stake.
I'm sure you probably noticed I think it was Orrin Hatch's office that initially put out the idea this past week that Planned Parenthood is 95% about abortions. And then when they were forced to retract that, they came out with some mealy-mouthed, well, it actually is 95% of the 3% that they do. In other words, they couldn't even admit they were wrong.
I think that was actually my dear Arizona Senator John Kyle, who said that it wasn't really intended to be a factual statement. Well, it wasn't. Guess what? but it is a powerful thing that we were able to call him on that, and that he had to at least say something in response. And you have to, I mean, there just is no choice but to constantly be observant, to constantly be vigilant, and to, you know, to take on every incorrect thing that's said and continue to bring it back to two things. Number one, the whole point of women's human rights, women's very being and very personhood and right to have a life. And also, I think, to really push back and not be afraid to do that and take it on.
I have bad news for you. Orrin Hatch did do the same thing.
Oh, did he?
There were two of them out there.
Orrin Hatch, when I was with Planned Parenthood and I was lobbying Orrin Hatch about something a number of years ago, he literally was poking his finger in my face and trying to convince me that he was the savior of women, because it was because of him that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was on the Supreme Court. And I've never forgotten that. He was so sure that he was the savior of women, and I guess I wouldn't have thought he would have said such a thing.
Well, that takes care of his lifetime obligation to acknowledge women.
Exactly. If you can see my tongue in my cheek.
I'm talking to Gloria Felt, who headed Planned Parenthood for 10 years, is the author of multiple books, and teaches women about power. We certainly need a lot of that. You know, one of the things, Gloria Felt, that I grew up in very conservative Indiana. One of the things that Planned Parenthood resorted to there, and I really commended them for it, they were not allowed to have their programs within some of the schools. So what they did was they trained some of the kids, local kids who were willing to do so, and taught them about how to use condoms, and they sent the kids into school with condoms so that, you know, Planned Parenthood couldn't be there distributing them or distributing the knowledge, but the kids could. Part of my concern these days is that while we have teenagers willing to do that, we also have teenagers who are still signing promises to be virgins. We have teenagers who still think that women save themselves from marriage. What do you see in the upcoming generations?
I'm very hopeful for the upcoming generations. I meet up with young women today who, and some of whom, by the way, like Shelby Knox, who have come out of that abstinence-only philosophy and have seen a different path. They have decided to take that was really not a very healthy path to take. And so I think there are a lot of young women who are prepared to lead, who have great passion for making women's lives better and for solving some of these problems that we have. What I fear is that they become cynical about politics in general, and that they back off from, you know, especially here we are talking about the war on women, but that kind of a conflict is not something that women tend to like. Mm-hmm. Tend to want to back off of conflict and controversy. And I believe one of the things that we need to teach young women, actually young men too, because I think democracy needs for us to be able to embrace controversy and use it in a thoughtful and productive way to actually engage the issues and not be afraid of the fact that we may have some differing opinions. Because once we can actually have the conversation, usually people find more in common than not. And I think there's a whole group of young women who, if they are given the skills to be effective in advocacy of all kinds, they will take that and they will run with it. And also, we have a generation of young women who are accustomed to being in charge of their own financial future. And I think that is a power that we often don't think of all that much, or we don't talk to them about all that much. The two things women need to be free in this world are the ability to control their own bodies and fertility, and the ability to support themselves, to have access to the money to be able to live a decent life. If you have those two things, nobody can coerce you. Nobody can make you do anything. And so I think that there's a whole younger generation of women who will surprise us and will really take things forward further than we ever imagined.
Gloria Fell, it's just been wonderful to talk to you, and I thank you for making yourself available.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Angie.
Gloria Felt, you can find her online at the link that we'll put on our website at indeep.org. Her latest book is No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. That's out from Seal Press. In our next hour, please try not to gag as I use the phrase the rise of Santorum, but seriously, what is behind that? Our executive producer is Gordon Whiting. Matt Fidler is our engineer. Our theme is by Big Troubles. David Gans provides our closing music. Thanks to Peter James Callahan at We Act Radio in Washington and Al Ginsberg at KRXA in Monterey. And I'm Angie Cairo. This is In Deep.
Oh, well, the man who stole the future has an oil drum for a heart and a strange preoccupation with other people's private parts.
Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep, which is a production of Live from the Left Coast. You can get more information on the show and our company at lftlc.com. Live from the Left Coast. While you're there, you can become a member and support our work. We have a separate website for the show that is indeep.org. If you have any questions or feedback, there's a contact button right there, indeep.org. We are developing a recurring series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy. And you're a big part of that. We'd like your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions. Send them in via our website, the contact button at indeep.org. Join us again this time next week for 2 more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Cairo. Thanks, and we will see you then. You are listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.